Judges chapter 1 is where we're going to pick up today. Judges chapter 1. We left off last week looking at the latter part of the chapter. And, you know, the time frame of Judges chapter 1 is after the death of Joshua. The book opens after the death of Joshua. The children of Israel asked the Lord who should go up first, and Judah went up first. So basically verses 2 through 20 summarize the conquests of Judah and Simeon. Simeon was within the borders of Judah, and they worked together. And then verse 21 through 36, the remainder of the chapter, focuses on the rest of the tribes. We left off last week at verse 27. We looked at verse 21, refers to the children of Benjamin. And then verse 22, it's the house of Joseph. Well, in verse 27, that's really a continuation of the house of Joseph, but we'll pick up in verse 27 today. Neither did Manasseh drive out the inhabitants of Bethshean and her towns, nor Tanakh and her towns, nor the inhabitants of Dor and her towns, nor the inhabitants of Ibleam and her towns, the inhabitants of Megiddo and her towns, but the Canaanites would dwell in that land. If you go back to verse 19, the Lord was with Judah and he drove out the inhabitants, but he could not drive out the inhabitants of the valley. So Judah got to a certain point and they stopped. And that had to be a failure of faith, a failure of obedience on their part, because it certainly wasn't a lack of power on God's part. But then that theme is kind of repeated. Verse 27, neither did Manasseh drive out. Verse 28, it came to pass when Israel was strong, they put the Canaanites to tribute and did not utterly drive them out. Verse 29, neither did Ephraim drive out. So as we're looking at the house of Joseph, verse 27, Manasseh, verse 29, Ephraim. They got to a certain point and they stopped. So you have the house of Joseph in verses 27, 28, 29. Verse 30, neither did Zebulun drive out the inhabitants of Kitron or Nahalal, but the Canaanites dwelt among them and became tributaries. Verse 31, neither did Asher drive out. Verse 33, neither did Naphtali drive out. So you kind of have this theme, neither did, neither did, neither did. It was kind of a cascading failure, if you will. Verse 28, I think, is kind of a summary of this whole process. It came to pass when Israel was strong, they put the Canaanites to tribute and did not utterly drive them out. So it seems like there was an acknowledgement by the original inhabitants that, yeah, Israel's strong. And yeah, you know, we got to be careful going against them. But they did resist in their own areas. And it's almost like they came to an understanding. If you stay there and you leave us alone and you pay us tribute money, we'll let you stay there and we won't try to kill you and drive you out. Because this idea of tribute in verse 28, verse 29, Ephraim did not drive out the Canaanites from Gezer. Verse 30, it says that Zebulun left some Canaanites that became tributaries. Okay, the end of verse 33, it says, neither did Naphtali drive out the inhabitants of, I thought about, you know, getting you to explain all of these cities and towns, but you know, we won't do that. But Beth Shemesh, Beth Anah, etc. The end of verse 33, they became tributaries unto them. Look at verse 34, the Amorites forced the children of Dan into the mountain, for they would not suffer them to come down to the valley, but the Amorites would dwell in Mount Heriz and Ajalon and Shalbim, but the hand of the house of Joseph prevailed so that they became tributaries. So multiple times here in the end of Judges chapter 1, you have this term, they became tributaries. Okay, what that means is not only, you know, did they militarily go against them and kind of ran up against a roadblock, but what that means is Israel agreed to, the different tribes of Israel agreed to, if I can say it this way, a ceasefire, a arrangement that allowed them to stay. They became tributaries means that Israel has signed off on this. It's not like, okay, we lost this battle, but we're going to regroup. And we're going to get some more recruits, and in a week or two, we're going down there again, and we're going to stay after this until we finish them off. They came to a tributary arrangement, and they just left it that way. I mean, this is nothing other than incomplete obedience. I mean, if we look at the classic passage on that same idea of doing some but not all of what the Lord has said, the classic passage on that would probably be 1 Samuel 15, right? 1 Samuel chapter 15, verse 11, it repenteth me that I've set up Saul to be king, for he has turned back from following me and has not performed my commandments. Now, what had Saul done? He'd killed a whole bunch of people. He'd conquered a whole bunch of area. But he kept Agag alive and he kept the best of the sheep and animals, right? So in what was God's estimation of that? He disobeyed. He did. He choked it away, for sure. That was his opportunity to have a lifetime kingdom, and he didn't. But, you know, God's assessment of Saul was, you didn't obey, you disobeyed. I mean, we would prefer to grade on the kind of grading scale that we have in school. Okay, I missed a few questions on the test, but I still made a B, right? 85%, you know, I'm still okay. 90%, you know, I'm doing pretty good. But when it comes to obedience, what's God's scale? 100%, or we could say it this way, pass, fail. If you disobey at all, you fail, right? 100%, that's the expectation. So later on in 1 Samuel 15, God said to obey is better than sacrifice and to hearken than the fat of rams. Rebellion is as witchcraft and idolatry, right? So the children of Israel did this same thing. But, you know, for them to make them tributaries means that they got to a point where they were okay with it. That's the part that, you know, I think really needs to be a lesson for us. I mean, not that they failed or that, you know, things didn't work out exactly as the original plan or anything like that. But if I get to a point where I accept disobedience, if you get to a point where you're okay with disobedience or okay with failure, okay with, you know, less than obedience to God, that's when judgment and defeat and difficulty comes. But they, obviously with the tributary relationship, they had accepted this fact. They were good with it, is how we might say it today. They had accepted this arrangement. Now, you see, again, I'm just going to kind of cherry pick some terms here, but in verse number 26, it mentions the Hittites. Verse 27, it mentions the Canaanites. Verse 28, the Canaanites. Okay, verse 34, when we're talking about the children of Dan, you get the Amorites. Again, in verse 36, the Amorites. If you look at those names, those are the exact same names as we continue to go through the book of Judges that they had to deal with later. So what you see, I mean, this is not rocket science, but I think it is important to understand, is that today's disobedience becomes the seeds of tomorrow's failures and defeats. You know, today's disobedience is the seed of tomorrow's failure and defeats. I mean, all of you have, you know, done some form of, you know, flower beds or weeding or gardening or that kind of thing. But, you know, around here, there in a lot of the areas, there's a lot of trees, right? You get the trees dropping the seeds, the acorns, whatever. But, you know, there's times where it's kind of right on the edge of the where you're going to mow. And you get a little thing that's like, you know, this big around and maybe this tall and you missed it. And next time it's kind of up like that and whatever, you know, I just kind of go around it. Done that before. And then later on, as it came up, I'm like, wait a minute, that looks like it's going to be a tree. That doesn't look like a little whatever, you know, and it doesn't, that thing can be like this tall and this big around, but just, oh, okay, well, this is probably a weed. I should pull it. No, that's not a weed. You know, sometimes if it's small enough, you grab with two hands and pull real hard and maybe you can still get it to come up. But even if it's a tree, it doesn't have to be real big before it's a problem, right? But now give it 2 years. And what was this is now this, or this, and now we got to have a saw, you know, and a lot more work to dig out the stump or the root, right? What I'm saying is that these enemies that were left as tributaries, they were allowed to remain in the land, may have looked like little bitty weeds like this, or little bitty problems, but it wasn't that long before they became major issues, major problems, major obstacles for the children and grandchildren of this generation right here. And, you know, those seeds of disobedience that they allowed to grow without pulling the weeds and digging them up grew into defeats and failures for their children and their grandchildren. So look with me again, if you would, in verse number 34. I think this is kind of embarrassing. The Amorites forced the children of Dan into the mountain, for they would not suffer them to come down into the valley. I mean, what has the pattern been up until this point? You know, God parts, stops the Jordan River, and they're all scared to death, and the walls of Jericho fall down. And as we see summarized in Joshua chapter 12 and 13, you have all these kings that were defeated. And now all of a sudden, you know, what should have been the conquering army is forced to retreat and stay in the mountains. No, we're not giving up the plains areas here. Now, we're told in other places that, you know, militarily there might have been an advantage on the side of the Amorites, but was there an advantage when it comes to the power of the false gods versus the God of Israel? Of course not, okay? But it's kind of embarrassing. Have you ever seen a little herd dog, a little cow dog, yip and snap and watch a big old cow kind of back up and run away? It's really kind of interesting that, you know, some of the border collies or different kinds of shepherds that they've bred specifically to work with cattle. It's kind of humorous. You know, it's kind of like you got the big German shepherd dog sniffing at the cat, and the cat swipes him one good time across the nose. Well, then, you know, that's kind of what I picture. I mean, if I can say it this way, Israel should have been the big dog or the bigger animal because of the power of God. And yet they're running away from the much smaller and less powerful animal. Why? Disobedience, defeat, or failure to rely on the power of God. So multiple times here, as we've already pointed out, you have this arrangement of they became tributaries. They were left behind. So then in chapter 2, what we see here, I threw the map in here one more time just so we can kind of see what we're talking about here. But the children of Dan, that is, as I understand it, either the greenish area, right? So you have the pinkish at the bottom, then you have our little soapbox derby card that we've talked about. And then it's kind of the greenish area, or there's kind of a tan area just to the left of that. But we're talking about central here, over towards the Mediterranean, okay? But all of those little pockets were, you know, the pieces that the land was divided into. So then in chapter 2, I think chapter 2 is basically a 30,000-foot summary of the entire book of Judges, okay? That's why I say that this is an assessment and synopsis of the time of the Judges in chapter 2, because it includes a little bit of, you know, the tail end of Joshua's life, and then it talks about basically the cycle that happened the entire period of the Judges. So really, in typical Jewish historian fashion, they kind of give you the bullet points, executive summary, and then go back and start filling in some of the blanks. But in Judges chapter 2, we see God's requirement. Verse number 1, an angel of the Lord came up from Gilgal to Bochim and said, I made you to go up out of Egypt, and I brought you unto the land which I swear to your fathers. And I said, I will never break my covenant with you, and you shall make no league with the inhabitants of this land. Ye shall throw down their altars. We'll stop there. We'll pick it up there in a minute. But that's God's requirement. I'm going to make a covenant with you. I'm going to help you. You're going to completely destroy all the inhabitants. Was that difficult to understand? Not really. As preachers before me have wisely said, it's not necessarily the parts of the Bible that I don't understand that are my problem. You know, it's obeying the ones I do understand that's the problem, right? But look with me in verse number 1 again. An angel of the Lord. In verse number 4, it says the angel of the Lord, okay? This could have been an appearance of God in human form, but as you probably know, the word angel means messenger. Okay, so it could be God's messenger. Usually when you get an appearance of a heavenly being, whether it's an angel or, you know, Christ in human form, usually they just kind of appear. You know, but it says here in verse 1, the messenger of the Lord, the angel of the Lord, went up from Gilgal to Bochim. That was a observable travel. So that kind of makes me wonder about it a little bit. But what was significant about Gilgal? At this point in time in the history of Israel, what's significant about Gilgal? Anybody remember? Yep. When they crossed over, where did they first make camp? Gilgal. The name Gilgal means rolling or rolling away. It's because while they were at Gilgal, that's where God came to them and said, hey, you've been disobedient. You haven't followed my command in the matter of circumcision. Now you got to deal with that. And it was at Gilgal where they dealt with that and made things right with the Lord. And then it was also at Gilgal where they observed the first Passover in the promised land. Okay, and that area around Gilgal became their encampment when they started the war campaigns and going the different directions, knocking off the largest or the most problematic of the enemies. So, but Gilgal was pretty special. I mean, if I could say it this way, when they crossed into the new land, Gilgal was where it started. Remember, in the early part of Joshua, God had told Joshua to have men grab stones. They had one from each tribe. And wherever they camped that night, they were going to set up the memorial. Well, that was at Gilgal. That's where the monument was made to the crossing of the Jordan and so forth. So I don't think that the place here is coincidental. I mean, just the fact that the messenger started at Gilgal would be emblematic of the fact that, hey, you remember when this first started, you remember what God told you. And then he went to Bochim. Well, Bochim is the new name of the place, kind of like Bethel. Remember, Jacob had the dream and angels going up and down on a ladder, and he said, this is the house of God, so he named it Beth-El, house of God. Well, Bochim is the new name here, as we're going to see here in a minute, but you have God's requirement. It was really simple. Get rid of all of them. Don't allow any of them to stay. And the other specific thing that's mentioned here in verse 2, make no league with the inhabitants of this land, which they'd already messed up with the Gibeonites, and ye shall throw down all their altars. Now, let's rewind to tributaries in chapter 1 for a minute. If they're making them tributaries but allowing them to stay, are they throwing down all their altars? No, they have made a conscious choice to allow idolatrous altars and idolatrous worship to remain in the land God gave them. You know, am I being too harsh? I don't think so. I mean, I think that's exactly what's going on here. So, God said, I told you not to make leagues with them and not to allow any of their altars to stand. So you have God's requirement. And then we have Israel's refusal. Israel's refusal. Look at the second part of verse number 2. You shall throw down their altars, the last phrase here. But ye have not obeyed my voice. And then the additional question, why have you done this? Israel's refusal. Now, if we were to look at Israel and say, you refuse to obey God, you think they would go, yeah, you're right. Or you think they'd bow up and defend themselves? I think they'd probably defend themselves, right? Just like you and I would. Hey, you haven't obeyed God. What are you talking about? I go to church, I pay my tithes, I read my Bible. You know, you start listing all the good things. But if God knows there's an area of obedience that has been intentionally ignored, how does God view that? It's disobedience. Partial obedience is total disobedience, right? So here, God's assessment is, ye have not obeyed my voice. So, I mean, if we're just going to be blunt and call it like God calls it, they refuse to complete the assignment. They refuse to complete the assignment. Why? Why didn't they drive them out? I mean, was it that, okay, this is hard and everything else was easy? I don't think so. I mean, they had had difficult tasks already. Was it that God ran out of power? I mean, God's power, and I'm trying not at all to be disrespectful here, but God's power is not like a battery that has to be recharged. Okay? God's power is not like a bank account that gets depleted with expenditures. I mean, God's power is unlimited. He's omnipotent. He can do anything. And he doesn't get tired. He doesn't have to sleep. He doesn't get worn out. All of those things. So it wasn't that God had run out of the ability to help them. So what does that mean? It got hard, and maybe they, you know, faltered in their faith. Or maybe, just maybe, they got tired of it. Right? We've been doing this a long time. Or, you know, another possibility is, that's good enough. Now, if you're, you know, weeding the flower bed or, you know, doing something like that, maybe good enough is okay. You probably know, okay, I'm going to have to come back and do this again in a couple weeks anyway, so that's enough for today. I mean, there might be some things where, that's good enough. I mean, for me, one of the first things I ever built by myself out of lumber was several years ago. I built a doghouse. Well, let me put it this way. I built a structure that would keep the dog out of the rain. I don't know how much it resembled a doghouse, but you know, I built a structure. Okay. Now, if it, in my personal view, it had a spot where you could get up off the ground, didn't have to lay on the ground. There's a roof over it. It was good enough. Okay. Is it going to win any prizes for architectural projects? No. I mean, if people say, "Where you get that doghouse?" I want to tell them, you know, I got it at a yard sale or something. I don't want to tell them I built it because it looks awful. Okay. But when it comes to building a doghouse, good enough's okay. All right? If it comes to, say, patching a hole in the fence, you know, to keep the animals in, it may not be pretty, but it gets the job done. Maybe good enough's okay. But if we ever get to the point where we're like, my obedience to the Lord is good enough. You know, I got a B+. You know, I got an A-. I think I'll be okay here. Then we got a problem. A good enough mentality when it comes to serving the Lord isn't good enough. Because God's expectation is full obedience to the best of our ability. Okay? God's expectation is that we follow through on what He's told us to do. So what you have here is a good enough mentality, and God's assessment is you rebelled, you refused, you disobeyed. So we have God's requirement, we have Israel's refusal. And then, just because I needed another word that started with R, we have God's reproving. Verse number 3. Wherefore, I also said, I will not drive them out from before you, but they shall be as thorns in your side, and their gods shall be a snare unto you. So you have God's rebuke, His reproving, His chastening of them. When they got to a certain point of disobedience, I mean, I'm sure God dealt with them prior to that, like He does with us. But when it got to a certain point when they were not listening to His conviction or reproof, He's like, okay, fine. I'm just going to let you deal with it. The New Testament says it something like this: be not deceived, God is not mocked. Whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. Exactly right. So in essence, God is saying, okay, fine, I'm just going to let you reap what you've sown. Now, verse number 4 is something, middle of verse 3 is something we can relate to. They shall be as thorns in your sides. I mean, I don't know who, I mean, obviously you can take it all the way back to Adam in the Garden of Eden, but I don't know who was responsible for transplanting the original seeds for what grows around here. But around here, if you leave land untended, there's these green vines with thorns on them. And they multiply like rabbits. I mean, it's like you can leave it alone for 6 days and there's 10 more of them. Where does it come from? I don't know. I have never seen any sort of fruit or berry or any kind of produce. It's just a complete and total nuisance. It's just thorns. And of course, you know, if you ever go deer hunting, where do the deer run away? If you're, you know, if you shot one, you're trying to track it, they run right in the middle of a patch of those. I mean, I don't particularly care for the thorns on blackberry vines either, but at least there's some fruit there, right? The ones I'm talking about are just these green vines that are about this big around. It's nothing but thorns. I mean, I think we can all identify with that. My son was at the teen activity the other night where they all went to shoot each other with plastic BBs and eye protection. Okay, just it's being live streamed, so I figure I better qualify that a little bit. When he came home and he was telling us about it, he said, my knee's killing me. He said, there must have been a thorn or something right where I kneeled down, because he kneeled down on the ground and took a position. He's kind of trying to shoot at the people on the other team. He said, there must have been thorns there, and it stuck right through the knee of my pants. And, you know, his knee was a little bit sore. I mean, we can identify with that. But God said, all right, fine. I'm going to let them be as much of a pain and an aggravation as the thorns. You know, but thorn in my hand, thorn in my knee. Thorn in my side just feels like it's got to be more painful, right? It just seems like it's got to be even more difficult. But God says, I'm going to leave them. In essence, I'm going to let you reap what you sow. And their gods shall be a snare unto you. The word snare means trap, right? What was the major thing that God warned Israel about over and over and over again through Moses? When God gave them the law at Sinai and he gave them the rest of the commandments, and they're going in, and even in Joshua, over and over and over again, what was, if I could say, the one major sin that he warned them about the most, what would it be? Yeah, say it louder. Idolatry. Idolatry, false gods. God knew that they were susceptible to that, which is why he made a big deal out of, you better avoid this, you better avoid this. So now he says, fine. You're not going to drive them out. Well, now this is going to be a snare. And if you go for that, like I know you're prone to do, then you're going to get the punishment that I've already promised for that. So God's allowing them to reap what they've sown. Verse 4, it came to pass when the angel of the Lord spoke these words unto the children of Israel, the people lifted up their voice and wept. I can understand that. I mean, if God looked at you and said, Jim, you've been disobedient, so now you're going to reap what you've sown. You know, Matthew, you've been disobedient, you're going to reap what you've sown. You know, you can fill your own name in the blank there. I don't think I'd be real happy with that. The Bible says here they lifted up their voice and wept, partly because I think they've been reproved by the Lord, but partly also because God said, all right, you're going to suffer consequences here. It's kind of like when you're dealing with your children, and they're real belligerent until they realize, okay, you know, the time of reckoning has actually come, and then it switches to the tears, right? Maybe it was a little bit of that. Look at verse 5. And they called the name of that place Bochim, and they sacrificed there unto the Lord. So Bochim there became the name of the place. Why? Look at verse number 4, the end of the verse. The people lifted up their voice and wept. The verb there, wept, is the Hebrew verb baka. You see that in the prophets. I think it's in Jeremiah where it talks about the valley of baka. It's sometimes spelled B-A-C-A or B-A-C-A-H. That is the Hebrew word that means weeping. Okay? Well, in verse 5, Bochim is another form of that same word. So they called the name of the place weeping. You know, verse 4 says they wept. And then they named the place of weeping. That's what Bochim means, the place of weeping. Which is why I said originally in verse 1 that when the messenger came from Gilgal to Bochim, I don't think Bochim was the original name of the place. I think they renamed it. Why? Because the people there wept before the Lord, but also wept because they were beginning to see some of the coming consequences of their disobedience. So you have God's reproving. All right, and then in the rest of chapter 2, you have the cycle repeated. You have God's requirement, Israel's refusal, God's reproving, and then we have the cycle that's going to be repeated. Now, we won't get through the entirety of chapter 2 in the next 4 minutes. But as we read through this, I think what you see in verses 6 through the end of chapter 2, which is verse 23, what you see here is an overview of what's going to happen for like the next 300 years in the period of the judges. This is kind of a synopsis, and then you get the play-by-play more or less when it talks about Othniel being a judge and Ehud being a judge and Gideon and Samson and all the different ones, okay? But look with me in verse number 6. When Joshua had let the people go, wait a minute. I thought Joshua was dead. Okay, well, we've rewound here a little bit. When Joshua had let the people go, the children of Israel went every man to his inheritance to possess the land. And the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua, and all the days of the elders that outlived Joshua, who had seen the great works of the Lord that he did for Israel. So the narration rewinds, okay? Joshua had divided the land. He'd given them all their inheritance. He blessed them, and he said, all right, go take it. From that point on, now you get the rest of this. Verse 7, the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders that outlived Joshua. I think this has been well described as first-generation believers and second-generation believers, right? I'm using the term believers because I'm not using the term Christians in the Old Testament. But the first generation was Joshua's generation. What does it say in verse number 7? Joshua, we know he knew God, and all the elders who had that outlived Joshua, who had what? Seen the great works of the Lord. Drop down to verse number 10. All that generation were gathered under their fathers. There arose another generation after them, which, here's two things, knew not the Lord, nor yet the works which he had done for Israel. So the first generation had two things. They knew God, they knew his works. Or if I could say it this way, they knew God personally. They had a firsthand relationship with God. They had seen the works of God. Okay, one way for me to describe this would be this. God has no grandchildren. God only has children. Okay, why do I say that? Because you're not automatically a child of God in the sense of New Testament salvation because of the family you were born into. Salvation is an individual choice. It is a personal relationship. And so even though you have children, you know, that you've tried to teach the things of God, they must accept Christ's salvation for themselves. Then they are the child of God and God is their father. So God has no grandchildren. But if you see kind of the natural process of that, if you assume that's what's the case, then you would have the first generation, second generation here. The first generation, according to verses 7 and 10, the first generation knew God and knew his works. They had seen God work personally. If I could say it this way, it wasn't just theoretical. You know, they had seen God move on their behalf, God provide for them, God defeat enemies for them. They'd seen God answer prayers. They had seen all of these things. The second generation had heard about it. They hadn't seen it. Now, part of me wonders if the first generation had seen all of that early on when they were going into the land and during the life of Joshua, and they still remembered it, but maybe they had not demonstrated that for the younger ones. I mean, we know that they put the Canaanites and all Amorites and all the other ites to tribute, right? So I think there's probably some fault on both sides. I mean, obviously God holds individuals accountable for their relationship to him. I think there's some responsibility on the part of the parents, too, that maybe they could have done a better job of demonstrating or teaching the works of God. Go back to Deuteronomy chapter 6, the Shema. You know, the parents were told to teach diligently their children in all these circumstances. But, you know, you have in the beginning of the cycle, the groundwork is laid. It's framed in this context. You have Joshua and his generation that knew God and knew his works. Then you have the next generation that didn't know God, didn't have a personal relationship with God. They had not seen the works of God for themselves. And when it was hearsay and mom and daddy's relationship and grandma's religion, that's the generation that very quickly went aside. I mean, I think all of us are aware, but it's just a reminder that we need to teach our kids and grandkids and pray for them that they have a firsthand relationship. Not, you know, secondary Christianity, but they have a personal relationship with God and they learn to obey God's word for themselves. That's the difference between these two generations. One knew God personally, one didn't. One saw God work, one didn't. We'll have to stop there for today. Lord, thank you for your word. Thank you for the reminders. And Lord, I pray that you'd help us to finish the tasks that you've given us. And I pray that you'd help us to be good examples and teachers for the generations after us. Pray for each one in this room that has children, grandchildren, that you would point them towards you, and Lord, that you'd help us to be the teachers in the way we should be. In Jesus' name, amen.